Let me take us to the jellyfish story because it's genuinely remarkable biology, and the HN community surfaced it with 135 points and 30 comments. Researchers at the Marine Biological Laboratory found that certain jellyfish species can heal significant wounds in a matter of minutes. Not hours, not days, minutes. The mechanisms involve cellular processes that are fundamentally different from vertebrate wound healing, which typically requires complex cascades of clotting, inflammation, and tissue regeneration.
The scientific significance is that jellyfish wound healing appears to bypass the inflammatory phase entirely, or compress it dramatically. In vertebrates, inflammation is both necessary for healing and one of the primary sources of scarring and collateral tissue damage. If you can identify the molecular mechanisms jellyfish use to skip or compress that phase, you have potential therapeutic targets for wound care, surgical recovery, and a range of inflammatory conditions. It's not close to clinical application, but it's the kind of basic science finding that tends to be the upstream source of important medical advances a decade later.
The Anna's Archive bounty is one of the most interesting stories of the weekend from a policy and intellectual property perspective. For context, Anna's Archive is a shadow library, a site that aggregates access to books and academic papers outside traditional copyright enforcement. They've posted a $200,000 bounty for anyone who can provide a comprehensive dataset of Google Book scans or comparable scans from similar digitization projects. The HN thread has 482 points and 274 comments, which tells you this hit a nerve.
The legal situation around Google Books is genuinely complex and worth understanding. Google scanned millions of books starting in the mid-2000s under a claim of fair use for search indexing. The Authors Guild litigation eventually settled in a way that allowed Google to display snippets while preventing full-text access without rights clearance. But the scans themselves exist. Anna's Archive's position is essentially that these scans, often of books that are out of print, culturally significant, and commercially inaccessible, should be part of the public record.
This is where I want to bring in our curriculum corner, because the antitrust dimension of the Google Books situation is actually the part that gets underappreciated. When people talk about Google's dominance in search or digital advertising, they're usually thinking about market share. And I want to explain why antitrust law is more nuanced than that, because it's directly relevant to how we should think about platforms like Google that accumulate vast archives of cultural material.
This is a good place to dig into it. Go ahead.
The Sherman Antitrust Act, passed in 1890, still the foundation of U.S. antitrust law, prohibits two main things: contracts or conspiracies that restrain trade, and monopolization or attempted monopolization of a market. The crucial point, which surprises a lot of people, is that having a large market share is not itself illegal. You can have 80% of a market and be completely compliant with antitrust law. What matters is how you got that share and what you do with it. The legal standard for monopolization requires proving two things: that the company has monopoly power in a relevant market, and that it acquired or maintained that power through exclusionary conduct, meaning conduct that harms competition, not just conduct that beats competitors by being better. A company that wins 80% market share by making a dramatically better product is fine. A company that wins 80% market share by locking competitors out through exclusive contracts, predatory pricing, or tying arrangements is potentially in violation.
And the relevance to Google Books specifically is that the question isn't whether Google has a large share of the book scanning market. It's whether their control of those scans, combined with their market position, creates barriers that harm competition in downstream markets: academic research, AI training data, digital library services. That's a much harder case to make, and it's part of why the Anna's Archive bounty is happening outside the legal system rather than inside it.
Exactly. The analog I'd use: it's not illegal for a supermarket to be big. It's potentially illegal for a supermarket to require that food manufacturers sell exclusively to them, which locks smaller grocers out of access to products. The question with digital archives is whether controlling access to scanned books functions like that kind of exclusive arrangement in practice, even without a formal contract requiring it.
The Command & Conquer Generals port to Mac OS, iPhone, and iPad using something called Fable, 588 points, 246 comments, is a story that deserves more explanation than old game runs on new platform. The technical achievement here is that this isn't a compatibility layer or emulation. It's a native port using a framework called Fable that the developer used to rewrite or bridge the game's core logic for Apple Silicon and iOS.
Command & Conquer Generals was a 2003 Windows game. The gap between 2003 DirectX Windows code and modern iOS Swift or Metal development is enormous. The fact that someone produced a native port, meaning it runs using the platform's actual graphics and audio APIs rather than translating DirectX calls on the fly, suggests Fable is a more capable bridging framework than most of what's come before. The HN thread gets into specifics about how Fable handles the translation layer, and several commenters with game engine experience expressed genuine surprise at how clean the result appears.
The Megawatts by Microwave piece, 30 points, 4 comments, covers a proposal for microwave power transmission from space-based solar collectors to ground receivers. This is a concept that's been discussed in aerospace and energy circles for decades, but is getting renewed attention because launch costs have dropped enough to make the economics potentially viable. The essay engages seriously with the physics and the engineering challenges rather than just hand-waving at clean energy from space.
The night sky pollution story from the European Southern Observatory, 152 points, 251 comments, is one where the HN community's reaction was notably more engaged than I'd expect for what sounds like an astronomical niche issue. The ESO report documents the threat to ground-based astronomy from the proliferation of satellite constellations and space mirrors. But the 251 comment thread reveals that this is actually a proxy for a much larger conversation about who controls shared commons, in this case, the night sky itself.
The specific numbers from the ESO report are striking. They're projecting that by the late 2020s, the density of satellites in certain orbital shells will make certain astronomical observations essentially impossible from the ground, even from the darkest sites. For professional astronomy, that affects science. But the cultural dimension is that the night sky has been accessible to every human being throughout history, and we're changing that permanently without any formal consent process.